This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. American baby boomers can reminisce endlessly about coming of age in the 60s. My guest David Gourovitch has a different story to tell. He grew up in the 60s in the Soviet Union. He managed to listen to Hendrix and Dylan and see Easy Rider three times, but there wasn't exactly a big counterculture in Russia. And as Gourovitch says, while young Americans rebelled by marching, Russians rebelled by not marching. Growing up in Russia in the 60s is the subject of Gourovitch's new memoir, From Lenin to Lenin, you know, from Vladimir to John. Gourovitch emigrated to the United States in 1976 at the age of 23. He was already fluent in English when he arrived, having worked as a translator in the Soviet Union. In the States, he's worked as a translator, teacher, and computer programmer. He's also a novelist and playwright. On the day he arrived in the West, there was a Newsweek article about Soviet emigres. When he found the article, he was excited, but by the time he was finished reading it, he was depressed.
I sort of looked at those guys, and they looked very photogenic in their beards, and they looked very intense, and they were, you know, they were dissident emigres. And formally, I was also an emigre, and I was forced into a dissident role at the reception center, where I was told that I better put down political as a reason for immigration. And I tried to fit myself into this stereotype, and that was kind of a sad feeling.
What was the stereotype that you didn't fit?
Well, the stereotype was somebody who is who has been persecuted for his faith, who has been fighting for his, you know, for human rights, who had suffered inhumanly at the hands of the KGB, and on and on and on. And you know, I mean, against the background of people like Sakharov or Solzhenitsyn, I certainly didn't suffer that much. Maybe I would have suffered if I had left, but I decided to bail out early.
Well, for you, the last straw in the Soviet Union was not being able to get a ticket to a screening of Last Tango in Paris.
Yeah, it's a very sad realization. You know, I mean, when I was reading the, I mean, I, it did not really come to me, it did not really dawn on me in full until I started writing this book. I was trying to pinpoint down this moment, and that's what came to mind. And again, you know, I feel very uneasy about this because obviously, you know, some people have, you know, more dramatic moments, you know, being arrested, being told all sorts of things by the KGB, what have you. And, but for me, it was the last straw. You know, it's, again, you know, I wish I could fit some kind of heroic stereotype, but that's just not it.
What was so impossible to bear about not being able to get a ticket to see Last Tango in Paris?
Well, you know, I just thought that, you know, for most people I know, especially the guy who I went to, you know, to the screening, who tried to get to the screening with, the thought that it was quite normal that this screening should be for some and not for others. You know, it was the fact that we, you know, like normal, ordinary people had to struggle to get to see a movie was normal to most people. And it just dawned on me that it's totally, you know, it's totally idiotic. It's abnormal. Things should not be this way. You know, and it was the realization that this society is totally screwed from top to bottom. And wild at heart, I don't know about that. But I went home thinking that this is total idiocy, this is total abnormalcy, and I should get out.
So you're not someone who was a dissident or an activist, but you are someone who loved movies and loved rock and roll, and you couldn't ever get enough of it. Part of what your book is about is... loving things like that and living in the Soviet Union where you didn't have much access to it. How would you get rock and roll records when you were a teenager?
Ooh, that's a science. There's so many ways. And, you know, incidentally, I mean, with all this variety of, you know, of ways of getting those things, once you come down, you know, once I came to the West, my interest started slipping. Because all of a sudden it was so wildly available. Actually, the companies wanted you to buy those things. you know, and I guess in my case, the reflection of the 60s spirit is that I immediately resisted this pitch to buy all the rock and roll records. But going back to your question, there was a number of ways. Mostly people who travel abroad, you know, they would be bringing records back. And they would either rent them out to be taped, you know, on tape recorder, or, you know, their friends, they would just allow you to tape them for free. This was the main, or you would get a couple of records of your own and you would be swapping it with friends.
What's a record you had in your collection that you were able to trade for a lot of other records? You know, something that was really valuable for barter.
That's funny. I didn't have... that was funny because I had a bunch. I had a friend bring me a bunch of Bob Dylan records, and to which I listened on and on and on. But then I realized that, and it seemed to me, you know, in my naivete, that everybody should be totally bananas over it. And it didn't turn out to be this way. It did not rate that high. However, you know, I had a David Bowie record, and I had a Jimi Hendrix record, and IU Experienced, as a matter of fact, and I was able to get a lot of mileage out of that.
You know, today is Bob Dylan's 50th birthday.
Yes, I know.
So what did Dylan mean to you in the Soviet Union? What did you make of his lyrics? You knew English fairly well when you started listening to Dylan, but, you know, his lyrics are so obtuse anyways. I'm wondering what you made of it in the Soviet Union.
Well, it was the mystery, I guess. I mean, I could not get the whole thing, obviously. But I don't think, you know, many Americans can get the whole thing. You know, like you said, obtuse, you know. And right now, of course, I realized that they were perhaps, a lot of this obtuseness was quite intentional. At that point, it was a little bit like... roving through his lyrics, I felt a little bit like Alice in Wonderland. You know, I did not quite know what, you know, whether to believe him or not to believe him. But the fact was that I received him viscerally rather than cerebrally.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, whatever it was, first it was truth. Okay, because this voice could not lie. Okay, and secondly, you know, so what if the truth is sometimes obscure? You know, it's truth nonetheless. You know, and if I'm, it's better to get 50% of truth than, 100 something that's 100% falsehood, but although it's coming to you abundantly clear.
You had friends who were in rock bands, and they'd sometimes, for performance, have to submit their lyrics to censors?
Absolutely. You see, the thing is that the in Russia, there was always this state... hypocrisy has always existed on the state scale. That is to say that the kids knew that they were playing just plain rock and roll, okay? And the people who were in charge of those shows, you know, the party ideological, the people in charge of ideology, they also knew it. But nonetheless, everything had to be labeled just so. And this is why, you know, stuff like Stairway to Heaven had to be labeled as English folk song. You know, Painted Black was, an anthem and a hymn against racism, et cetera, et cetera.
So did they have to change the lyrics?
They didn't, because they were singing in English anyway. And, you know, in rock and roll, I mean, you wouldn't be able to recognize those lyrics the way those guys killed the phonetics. So it's very funny the way, you know, English is being transformed.
Were there officially sanctioned rock songs that officially sanctioned people wrote that had really stupid lyrics?
In Russia?
Yeah.
All the lyrics were stupid. You know, the thing is that, like I said, you know, the term rock and roll itself was pretty much in the, you know, in the official lingo, in the Russian newspeak, it was associated with something Western corrupting, you know. So the official term was pop music. And a lot of this was actually, you know, looking back on it, a lot of it was much closer to Euro, what we know as Euro pop rather than American rock and roll. And all those lyrics were totally hilarious. Like I said, you know, it was something about lovelorn geologists lost in the Siberian taiga and missing their girlfriend and something like this. Because, you see, in the official Russian lore, love can only be a byproduct of being loyal to the state and be doing something useful for the state. Therefore, you know, if there was some kind of love feeling, it was not just she loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah. She loves you because you're doing something good for the state. That was basically the core of any Russian pop song.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Gorevitch, and he's written a new memoir called From Lenin to Lenin. That's from the Soviet thinker to the Beatle. And it's a memoir about growing up in the Soviet Union in the 60s. And Gorevitch emigrated to the United States in 1976 at the age of 23. And he's worked as a translator, a computer programmer. He's also a novelist and playwright. We'll take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Soviet emigre David Gorevitch is my guest, author of the new memoir, From Lenin to Lenin. The draft was a very big issue for young men in the 1960s in the United States because of the Vietnam War. Apparently the draft was a big issue for you, too. When you were coming of age, the draft age was lowered to 18, but I guess you could still get a college exemption?
Yeah, and that's how I chose college on the basis of evading the draft, because originally I wanted to go to journalism school, but after doing some reconnaissance, I figured out that my chances were very slim, because all of a sudden in the Russian late 60s, journalism has become the most fashionable profession. And so I figured I would go to the language school, because I figured that with my English I had a better edge.
So going to college got you out of the draft for good?
No, it was merely a 5-year exemption. Because, you know, the college term in Russia is 5 years, and you get a 5-year exemption. However, in my college, we took military courses, and we were supposed to be military officers, you know, after graduation. We were supposed to be in the reserve. But my case was a clear-cut catch-22, because I was trained, if I was to be an officer, I was to be in the Army Intelligence. And of course, with 0.5, what they call 0.5 in Russia, meaning Jewish, you know, I could never be trusted to be in Army Intelligence. So they could not draft me as an officer. And by law, they could not draft me as a soldier either, because I already took some officer courses. Ergo, they could not draft me.
Wow, what really convoluted...
Of such convolutions is life in Russia. You know, life in Russia is made.
When you moved to the United States, how well did you relate to other Soviet emigres?
Well,
I should say here that because you were a translator, you spoke English. Maybe you didn't know colloquial English that Americans speak all that well, but you had a grasp of the language, so you weren't forced to rely on other Soviets to help you understand what Americans are saying.
Yeah. Well, you know, you have to, it was a little weird because, frankly, I felt a little bit, ghettoized. And I was trying to break out of this, what I would say, self-imposed ghetto on their part quite actively. And so most of my friends and most of my social scene in those days was very much American.
During part of your early years in the United States, you translated for Soviet emigres on public assistance.
I still do.
Oh, you still do?
Oh, yeah.
Tell me some of the predicaments that Soviet emigres have been involved with that they really didn't understand, that you've had to help them out
of. Well, it's an interesting phenomenon, because I think, first of all, I'd like to say that I think that of all groups involved, covered by public assistance, the Soviets are probably one of the few groups for whom it really works. Because it really works as a bridge, the way I think that the social welfare system, was designed in the first place. I have not seen a Russian who has been, very few Russians I have seen have been on welfare for more than a year. I mean, they really use this time, they really go to school and takes all sorts of courses and they get out of it. In the second place, I think that there has been, on their part, the most common feeling is that when they literally expected of America, you know, to the streets to be paved of gold and with gold, and they really expected to be America to be something so drastically different from Russia. And let's face it, you know, welfare system is not very different from Russia in many ways. It's bureaucracy, it's red tape, it's incredible incompetence, inefficiency. It's the opposite of meritocracy. And they're shocked by it. And, you know, I have every time, you know, I talk to them, I have to bring them down to earth, so to speak. You know, because I tell them, if you want to, you know, be in America proper, you have to get a job and, you know, go into private sector as best of all, probably. And another thing that boggles, you know, just totally boggles their imagination is that Russian bureaucracy, they knew how to deal with, okay? They always know that you cannot, you know, meet it headlong, you know, you cannot face it in a dumb way. You have to find ways around it. You have to find loopholes. You have to find somebody who knows somebody else who works in the such and such position. In other words, you don't just walk into a clerk's office. You say, hi, I'd been talking to Ivan Ivanovich, and he told me to talk to you. You know, I mean, it's like a municipal system in New York or Chicago. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's how the entire Russian system works. And anybody who got his job through patronage, you know, in New York or Philadelphia or Chicago knows exactly how the system works.
Have there been difficulties for you having freedom and choices that you weren't used to having in the Soviet Union?
Well, you know, I it's still with me. You know, it gets much better, but it's still with me. It's what I call the unbearable burden of freedom. You know, it's very hard once, you know, when you get, you know, when you're used to the system where there's only one of anything and you're lucky if you get, you know, this one item, you know, it's very hard. And I can see it from, and I can see it, you know, on the example of, you know, the Soviets who come to America these days, you know, my relatives and my friends and, you know, other people, you know. And I think another problem is that the problem that I have barely started coming to terms with is that I think that every American has, growing up in a free society, has some notion of how to sell him or herself. And I don't mean like in literal sense, but, you know, he or she would operate in a free market. And whether we're talking about an interview for a job with the university or, you know, selling insurance or what have you. But every American has this skill, however small a scale. Russians have no idea of any of this. You know, like I said before, you know, in Russian system, the way of getting something is going over there, you know, making a few calls and saying, look, I talked to Ivan Ivanovich and he told me that you might have this and that for me. Okay.
So the way to get something in the Soviet Union is to pull strings, not to sell
strings.
Yourself.
No, it has nothing to do with selling yourself. And that's why I think that, I mean, the only people who knew how to sell things in Russia were the black marketeers. And even they were far from, you know, American model. So I think this is going to be a tremendous, tremendous obstacle in terms of Russians' progress towards a more open society, because they have absolutely no idea what market is. I mean, the oil professor market right now in Russia has replaced the place of Marxism on the official altar. I mean, you meet like the most hardcore party official, he will say to you, we believe in market. Of course, it will be our new socialist market, but we believe in market. We're moving towards market. The guy has no idea what market is, but now it's the new dogma.
Right.
You know, Dale Carnegie is the bestseller. I mean, you have seen the book, Leah Yakaka's book is on every bookshelf.
In the Soviet Union, right?
Oh, yeah. You can. It's like in every corner.
That's really interesting.
You know, I mean, this is the country where they worship capitalism, you know, like they never worshipped Marxism. The trouble is they still don't know what the hell they're worshipping.
Huh. You know, in your book jacket cover, you're wearing a denim jacket. And that reminded me that, you know, Levi's really had just a special, almost magical image about them when you were in the Soviet Union. So does that still hold any power over you?
Well, it does in a sense, because this is my, you know, this is my way of dealing with the same freedom that we talked about before. You know, it's very easy for me to buy jeans. You know, I don't go around in the shop around. I just go to the store and buy Levi's. That's it. You know, rather than dealing with the...
with all the choices.
With all the choices.
100,000 brands of blue jeans.
That's right. That's right. Unfortunately, I mean, what kills me is that unfortunately Levi's has come, you know, with the 20 varieties themselves, you know. So it's you know, I mean, they have all those fly buttons and schmai buttons and, you know, I don't know how to deal with this. But actually the choice of the jacket on the cover was not mine, it was the photographer's. You know, I mean, if you ever have been photographed for anything, you know that you have absolutely no say in how you're going to be photographed, what you're going to be wearing, you know, how you want your hair. The moment you say, okay, take my picture for the book jacket, I mean, you are the bonded slave. That's it.
David Gurevich, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you. It was fun.
David Gurevich is the author of From Lenin to Lenin, a memoir of Russia in the 60s.